A reading from the book of Isaiah. Wait, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will be feeble, and every human heart will melt, and they will be dismayed. Pangs and agony will seize them. They will be in anguish like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at one another. Their faces will be aflame. See, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with wrath and fierce anger, to make the earth a desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pride of the arrogant and lay low the insolence of tyrants. I will make mortals more rare than fine gold, and humans than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken out of its place at the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. As Jesus came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings." Then Jesus asked him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." Well, Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple. Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us when this will be, and what will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished?" Then Jesus began to say to them, "Beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name and say, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray. When you hear wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. This is but the beginning of the birth pangs. As for yourselves, beware. For they will hand you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings because of me, as a testimony to them. And the good news must first be proclaimed to all nations. When they bring you to trial and hand you over, do not worry beforehand about what you are to say, but say whatever is given you at the time. For it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. And you will be hated by all because of my name. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. But when you see the desolating sacrilege set up where it ought not to be, let the reader understand, then those in Judea must flee to the mountains. The one on the housetop must not go down or enter the house to take anything away. The one in the field must not turn back to get a coat. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that it may not be in winter. For in those days there will be suffering, such as has not been from the beginning of the creation that God created until now, no, and never will be. But if the Lord had not cut short those days, no one would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, whom he chose, he has cut short those days. And if anyone says to you at that time, 'Look, here is the Messiah,' or 'Look, there he is,' do not believe it. False messiahs and false prophets will appear and produce signs and omens to lead astray, if possible, the elect. But be alert. I have already told you everything. But in those days after that suffering, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Then he will send out his angels to gather his elect from the four winds and from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things take place, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But about that day or hour, no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Beware, keep alert, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. Therefore, keep awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening, or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, keep awake. The Gospel of Christ.
Mark chapter 13 is often referred to in scholarly circles and in some Christian books that you might read from time to time. It's often referred to as the Olivet Discourse. And the reason it's called that is because everything that Jesus has to say here is said while he is on the Mount of Olives. And so, hence the name. The Olivet Discourse is not only in Mark 13, but it'll appear later in the next gospel, Matthew chapter 24, and then also in Luke chapter 21. It doesn't appear in the Gospel of John. And when you hear about the Olivet Discourse, most of the time, in fact, probably like 99% of the time, what you're reading will talk about how Jesus is predicting and prophesying the last days, the end of the age, the end times, giving an allusion to the final judgment that is to come. And part of the reason we think that way is because the language he uses in this chapter definitely sounds a lot like that. We're going to talk about that in a second. But I'm going to suggest to you that probably more of the reason why we tend to think that it is about the last days is because modern versions of the Bible try to be very, very helpful with the scriptures and will insert subtitles that are not part of the original text, but they'll insert these subtitles to help us kind of get what's coming next. So in the previous chapter, chapter 12, for example, one of the challenging teachings that Jesus gives on the Tuesday of Holy Week is he teaches the people a parable about these wicked tenants. And he's speaking about the chief priests and scribes and elders. And so in the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible, you'll see this subheading appear that says, the parable of the wicked tenants. It's not part of the scriptures, but it's meant to be there to help you think what this next chunk is about. When we get to chapter 13, it's often broken up into several sections. And at least one of those sections, from what you heard Margaret read this morning, will be entitled Signs of the End of the Age. And sometimes even more pointed. In the New International Version of the Bible, there's just one subtitle at the beginning of the entire chapter, and it talks about prophecies about the temple and the end times. And so when you read these subtitles, you're already expecting that whatever comes next has to be about the end times, or has to be about the end of the age, understanding it to have to do something about with the final judgment. I'm going to suggest to you today, actually I'm going to argue, that Mark chapter 13 is not at all about the last days. It's not at all about the end times. But instead, Jesus is answering a question that his disciples right then and there were asking. The chapter opened up with them getting ready to leave. They've been in the temple. Jesus has been doing all sorts of this teaching. And as they're leaving the temple, his disciples turn to him and say, "Look, Master, at the huge buildings and these huge stones." They're rather amazed at the magnificence of the temple right there in the center of Jerusalem. Now, remember, these disciples are from Galilee. They live 3 days away. They're in rural Israel. They come down to the big city of Jerusalem a few times every year for, you know, special ceremonies and feasts and so on. And so If we can go ahead and pick on the little Albertan town of Oyen again, it's like people living in Oyen coming to Calgary a few times a year. You can easily imagine somebody living out in the boonies coming into downtown and looking at the Bow Building and the Calgary Tower and the Twin Bankers Hall buildings or something, going like, "Man, these are crazy. There's nothing like this where we live." And the disciples are remarking at the beauty of the architecture. And Jesus says to them, "I tell you the truth, the day is coming when not one of these stones will remain on top of another. All will be thrown down." And by answering that way, he isn't even suggesting that eventually these things will erode and just disappear. No, the fact they're going to be thrown down means they are going to be destroyed, which I hope you can appreciate is a really alarming thing for the disciples to hear, because Israel has already lived through the destruction of the temple once before, and the idea of it being destroyed again is a very alarming prospect. So after Jesus makes that comment, they leave Jerusalem, they come to the Mount of Olives, which is to the east of the city, and so on the slope of the Mount of Olives, you get a great view of Jerusalem itself, and especially of the temple. And while they're there looking at this vista, Peter, James, John, and Andrew, the first four disciples Jesus ever called, come to him privately and say, "Tell us, Master, when will these things be, and what will be the sign that they're going to happen?" What is the question they're asking? "You just said the temple's going to be destroyed one day. When is the temple going to be destroyed? And what are the signs going to be that it's going to happen?" And the rest of chapter 13 is Jesus answering that question. Now, the way he answers the question, though, is in keeping with the prophetic tradition that has been part of Israel's history. He answers like one of the prophets. Again, Jesus started off being recognized as a rabbi and being recognized as a prophet. The disciples come to conclude that he is the Messiah. That rumor is going around right now and all of that. But Jesus answers in keeping with the way that Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel and Hosea and Habakkuk and Zechariah have been talking. And he uses vivid language to get the point across about this huge event. And we cannot underestimate how incredible it would be for his disciples to hear Jesus say that this magnificent temple is going to be gone one day. And so they're wanting to know, when is this going to happen? And how are we going to know this? What are the signs that it's going to happen? And Jesus' answer in this chapter is all about that. He begins by saying to them, "Beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name and say, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray." Jesus knows that he's coming to the end of his time. He's already prophesied three times. He's already said three times that he's going to be put to death. He's now in Jerusalem, and he knows that he is going to die. But he also knows that there will be people who will come up after him and claim to be him, to be the reincarnation of Jesus or whatever, or to be the Messiah. "Jesus wasn't, I'm the Messiah instead." And they are going to lead people astray. Well, how are they going to be led astray? Well, they're going to say, "That guy didn't know what he was talking about. The temple's not going to be destroyed. Are you kidding? God would never let that happen again. This is the central place." Well, the thing is, this kind of thing already happened in the time of Jeremiah. Jeremiah is prophesying to the southern kingdom of Judah. Understand, the Babylonian Empire is going to come and destroy Jerusalem and destroy the temple, and you're going to be taken off into exile for 70 years. And all the other prophets around Jeremiah are going, "He doesn't know what he's talking about. There's no way that's going to happen. After all, this is the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh, the temple of Yahweh. It's on Mount Zion. There's no way God will let that happen." And even if he should, if we get sent into exile, it's going to be 1 or 2 years max, not this 70 years that Jeremiah is talking about. And they led the people astray into believing that this wasn't going to happen. And Jeremiah was proved right. Jesus is saying the same thing is going to happen. He's just said the temple's going to be destroyed. It happens to be that it is destroyed 40 years after Jesus says these words, but nevertheless, it happens. But there will be people who will come and try to say, "Don't worry about it, it's not going to happen." So Jesus warns them right away in the same way that Jeremiah had to warn others. And then he says, when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. Well, what is the end? Well, the destruction of the temple. And so this phrase, wars and rumors of wars, can also be translated wars and insurrections, wars and tumults is another way that another version translates it. And what basically this is saying is that there's going to be all sorts of conflict at various times. And sure enough, in the next 40 years, there are several different uprisings that take place. The most notable, of course, is what's known as the Jewish Revolt that takes place from 66 CE through to 74 CE. And it is because of this Jewish revolt that the Romans come in 70 CE and destroy the temple. And then 4 years later, the last survivors on Masada take their own lives rather than fall into the hands of the Romans. So that's that huge one right there, 8 years long. But even prior to that, there would be these various conflicts. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. And those things did also take place over the next 40 years. There were moments of earthquake in the region, and famines had taken place as well. And then he says, this is but the beginning of the birth pangs. I hope you caught that in Isaiah 13, Isaiah was prophesying, and he talked about the fact that pangs and agony will seize them. They will be in anguish like a woman in labor. Perhaps there's a connection here between what Jesus is saying in answer to this question and what Isaiah had said before. We're going to come back to that in a second. He then warns his disciples and says, as for yourselves, beware, for they will hand you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings because of me as a testimony to them. He goes on to describe how families will even turn on each other because of the message of Jesus, because of the message of Christ that they're going to continue to proclaim. And so he's telling his disciples who are right before them, watch out, there's going to be this time of persecution that's going to come. And why would they be beaten in synagogues? Well, because they're going to be proclaiming Jesus's message, which was certainly at odds with Jewish leadership. And so we ought to be prepared for this, Jesus is saying. And of course, sure enough, this does happen. In Acts chapter 7, Stephen is the first one to be martyred. We find later on that Peter is put to death by Emperor Nero in 64 CE. The Apostle Paul, who isn't even in the picture yet, is also put to death in that year. Prior to that, we have James being put to death in Jerusalem. The temple doesn't get destroyed until 70 CE, and all of these things take place. Jesus is already saying, expect this is going to happen. Now, let me stress, Jesus is not saying to us that this is going to happen to us. The church has taken it as part of its tradition to watch out and expect to be persecuted. But he isn't talking to us. He's talking to his disciples who are right there in Jerusalem. And Jesus just 2 days earlier was flipping tables all over the place in the temple. And if they're associated with him, they're going to have the same dim view of them that they already had for Jesus. He's not talking about end times. He's talking about what's going to happen up until the temple is destroyed. And so he makes this point for them. You will be hated by all because of my name, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. Well, to what end? Again, the destruction of the temple. You get through all of that period, there's no longer a temple for the Jewish people to be concerned about, and life is going to be different. Which it proved to be. In the middle of this, he says, the good news must first be proclaimed to all nations. And when people read that, they go, aha, see, that's got to be about the end times, because there are 200 and something nations in the world right now. Have all of them had the gospel proclaimed to them yet? No, but Jesus said the gospel must be proclaimed to all nations. So there you can see, he must be talking about some future thing, because that hasn't happened yet. Well, when we look at what was understood to be the world and to the nations back then, there is no interest described in the scriptures whatsoever about what's happening in China or what's happening in Turtle Island at these times. The world is that Mediterranean world. And the Apostle Paul, later in one of his letters, will say that he has taken the gospel to the world. He had gone on 3 missionary journeys, perhaps even a 4th, before he was executed in 64, and he was saying that the gospel has already been proclaimed all around the world. So Jesus might very well be using the same kind of, it's going to be proclaimed everywhere thing. But there's another reason to think that Jesus isn't prophesying that every one of the 200 and something nations we know of today is going to be hearing the gospel personally. And that is this: the Greek word for nations is the exact same word for Gentiles. And so the gospel will be preached to the Gentiles. The gospel will be preached outside of Israel. Jesus has already done that a bit in the northern part. He had gone outside the borders of Israel for a bit, but is still primarily a Jewish focus. And here he's saying, as this time progresses, in this time leading to the destruction of the temple, the Gentiles will have the gospel preached to them too. And that is exactly what happened. Paul's 3 missionary journeys, perhaps his 4th, plus what Peter was doing in Tyre and Sidon. And, you know, the idea is that this gospel is going beyond Israel, which is an important thing to keep in mind as we explore what Jesus's point is in saying all of this. But then he says, when you see the desolating sacrilege set up where it ought not to be, then those in Judea must flee to the mountains. And he goes on with warning there. Here's the big sign: when you see the desolating sacrilege set up where it ought not to be. Another translation calls this the abomination that causes desolation, which is a phrase taken from the book of Daniel. And when you hear those words, the abomination that causes desolation, people nowadays tend to think of that as having to do with the Antichrist and the end times and the beast and all this stuff. And sure enough, you see that language appearing again in the book of Revelation. And so people go, well, because Revelation talks about that, which is certainly talking about stuff after the destruction of the temple, they're saying, well, this means what that's what Jesus was talking about. Well, not so fast. The book of Revelation was written 30 years after the Gospel of Mark was written. It was written 65 years after Jesus did his thing. There is no indication in this passage that Jesus is referring to this episode as something to happen yet in the future. He's using the language of Daniel to help make his point. Now, what is Daniel talking about? Daniel is talking about the fact that this man came in and set something up in the temple that desecrated it. In this case, it's Antiochus IV Epiphanes, a Greek general who in 167 CE sacrificed a pig on the altar or set up an idol in it, desecrating the temple. And Jesus said that same kind of thing is going to happen again. When you see that happen, get ready, it's going to go down. And sure enough, the emperor Titus, if I remember correctly, comes into the temple in Jerusalem and sets up the eagle of Rome or some other thing, desecrating the temple shortly before it is destroyed. So Jesus says, when you see this thing happening, get ready. And he tells people in Judea need to get out of there, get to the mountains. If you're out in the field, don't come back and get your coat, you know. Just hit the road because it's coming down when that happens. And then he says a couple of interesting things. He says, you know, it's going to be bad for those who are pregnant or those who are nursing children in those days. Why? Well, because it's hard to flee for your life if you're great with child or if you've got this little bundle of joy you're trying to take care of at the same time. And then he says something curious. He says, pray that it will not happen in winter. That phrase is one of the clues that suggests to us that the Gospel of Mark was written before the destruction of the temple. Because Jesus is saying by that, pray that it doesn't happen in winter, that he doesn't know exactly when this is going to happen. He'll say that later, you know. Only God knows. The angels don't know. The Son of Man doesn't know, you know, the day or hour. No one knows. Just God does, right? Well, here he's implying that. Pray that it doesn't happen in winter. Now, winter back then is not like winter, or back over there, sorry, isn't like winter here, but it's a wet season. It makes travel difficult and challenging. But it turns out that the temple's destroyed in the summer of 70 CE. So Jesus is simply warning them about what is coming, this destruction of the temple. And he's saying the siege is going to come, the attack is going to come. You don't want to be here when that happens. So when you start seeing these signs, guys, get out of Jerusalem. And if you are, then you will be saved. you won't fall prey to the sword of Rome if you pay attention, if you keep awake and watch for what's happening, and you'll be spared all of that. Then Jesus drags more language from Isaiah into this. And this is where we start thinking, well, surely this has got to be about last days, right? And if anyone says to you at that time, look, here is the Messiah, or look, there he is, do not believe it. False messiahs and false prophets will appear and produce signs and omens to lead astray, if possible, the elect. I find that a really fascinating statement, not only that Jesus is saying that there will be false messiahs and false prophets, but that he says that they too will produce signs and omens, and it will cause people to be deceived. What does that say about Jesus' own signs and omens, or at least what Jesus thinks about his own signs and omens and wonders? If he says there's going to be other people that can do the same kind of thing that I've been doing, and will lead them astray, it's telling me that Jesus is not banking on his signs as being the key thing that sells people on who he is. Because there's going to be people who come afterwards who do zoomy things as well and cause people to think that they're the Messiah instead and Jesus wasn't. Keep that in mind. Jesus is not leaning on his signs as being the key about what he's all about. He goes on and says, be alert. In those days after that suffering, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. And we can look at that and go, that's got to be about last days, end times, judgment coming. Well, let's look at where that language came from. You heard Isaiah 13 when Noel read it this morning. The day of the Lord is near. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. See, the day of the Lord comes, cruel with wrath and fierce anger, to make the earth a desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. The stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising and the moon will not shed its light. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. We look at that and we go, that's got to be prophecy about final judgment, right? Well, this is a portion of Isaiah 13. And the beginning of Isaiah 13, this is not a subtitle that was added to the text. This is actually part of Isaiah. It says, the oracle concerning Babylon that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw. And what we heard read is part of what Isaiah said to the southern kingdom of Judah when he is warning them that Babylon is going to come and lay siege to them and destroy the temple and carry them off into exile. But the day is also coming that God will ensure that Babylon itself is defeated. And so Isaiah is prophesying about the fate of Babylon and uses this huge language, this global language, this apocalyptic language to describe what is going to happen when that day comes. I will make mortals more rare than fine gold. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble and the earth will be shaken out of its place at the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, will be like Sodom and Gomorrah when God overthrew them. It will never be inhabited or lived in for all generations. Isaiah is emphasizing the defeat of Babylon, and he gets that last part wrong, because Babylon is still inhabited. It's still there. You can go see it in Iraq today if you want. But the point is, Isaiah is using this prophetic, apocalyptic language that includes like a global reference while referring specifically to Babylon being defeated. Jesus is using very similar language to emphasize the point, the unbelievable point, that the temple is going to be destroyed. He's not talking about something that still hasn't happened yet. And so, by saying this, there's one more statement that has got to lock it down, right? He goes on to say, then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. See, right there, that's got to be, that's like the rapture or the second coming or something, right? the Son of Man will come on the clouds. Well, is that what he's emphasizing? Why do we think we have to take that literally? Well, because the Bible says he's going to come on the clouds. Well, it also says that he will have his angels gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. Where's the end of heaven? Where are the ends of the earth? Are there only four winds? Winds come from the northeast and from the south-southwest. Well, that's metaphorical. You know, the angel, are angels actually literally going to gather people? Well, it's a metaphor. Okay, if that part's a metaphor, why can't the Son of Man coming on the clouds also be seen as a metaphor? You see, Jesus hasn't been saying anything his entire ministry about a second coming. He hasn't been talking about the end times at all. Instead, he's been talking about life now and the kingdom of God now and how the kingdom of heaven is near and how we are to live in it. And so this image of the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, here's what Jesus is saying. When the centerpiece of Jewish worship is absolutely obliterated, when the dwelling place of Yahweh is once again utterly destroyed, people whose religious life is centered on that temple are now once again at a loss, just like they were 600 years earlier in the first exile. Everything is going to be overturned. How do you live out a third of the Torah, which is all centered about worship at the temple? But you know what will be absolutely untouched and will come out in glory on the other side of that day? The teaching of Jesus, which does not require the temple. Everything that Jesus taught and proclaimed, and as he implied by going in and cleansing the temple and overturning things and just making a mess of it, it's not necessary whatsoever. What will happen is after this crisis event takes place, what Jesus had to talk about is completely untouched by it. And in that way, the Son of Man will come on the clouds with glory and power, because everything the disciples have been learning from Jesus, it doesn't matter that the temple was destroyed. Because everything Jesus had to teach doesn't require the temple. It doesn't require it at all. It also doesn't require church buildings, honestly. It's nice having them. It helps us as we gather in times like this. But being a follower of Jesus, being one who follows in Jesus' way, doesn't require these things. The way of the temple is coming to an end, but the way of Jesus will continue without end. And that's the point he makes towards the end, that I know I have to wrap this up. He says, so also when you see these things taking place, you know that it is near at the very gates. Truly I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. That verse right there has caused all sorts of consternation for people who are convinced Jesus is talking about some future event that still hasn't happened. Because if he said this generation will not pass away until this has taken place, now you have to reinterpret what generation means. When there's been 2,000 years worth of generations that have gone and we still haven't seen the second coming. But if he's not talking about the second coming and he's talking about the destruction of the temple, well, then he's absolutely correct. Apart from those who have been martyred before that day, the people he was talking to were around when the temple was destroyed. And the generation of which they were a part was there when the temple was destroyed. But then he goes on and he says, look, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Two things about this to leave you with. When Jesus says heaven and earth will pass away, he is not saying heaven and earth will pass away. It's been taken to be so. And that's why the thought is that one day the earth is just going to be wadded up and thrown into the garbage, and we get to go to heaven instead. So who cares about environmental responsibility? Who cares about trying to save the planet? Because God's just going to throw it away later, because Jesus said heaven and earth will pass away. It's not what Jesus is saying. The emphasis is, look it, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. He is using an illustration of comparison to emphasize that his words will continue. Now, what are Jesus' words? He's not talking about the Bible. The New Testament doesn't even exist yet when he's saying these words. And he's not saying that the Hebrew Bible are his words. What are his words? Everything he's been teaching in the previous 12 chapters of this gospel. Everything Jesus is teaching, everything he is saying, everything he is demonstrating, everything he is calling people to, he says that will never pass away. Why? Because it doesn't get destroyed with the temple. It doesn't disappear when the temple is gone. It extends beyond Israel itself. It extends beyond the Jewish people. It includes the Gentiles. It includes anybody, anywhere in the world. And that is exactly what we have found to be the case in the Christian faith. It is not dependent upon where you're from. It's all about following in Jesus's way, following the path laid out by him, listening to the teaching that he has said, teaching that is universal in scope, that anybody is able to follow, which makes it truly universal in its effect. What we need to take from this passage is the understanding that the things Jesus had to say didn't come to an end when the temple was destroyed. And it has never come to an end. And it never needs to be seen to come to an end. But let us understand what he is talking about. It's what he's been demonstrating and teaching and showing. Our psalm today could be applied to what Jesus is saying. It calls out saying, Lord, teach me your ways, lead me in your paths, guide me in the way that you would have me go. That's the whole idea behind Psalm 25. And we can apply that today. The way of Jesus goes beyond the way of the temple, and it continues to this very day. Amen.